Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and we have a very, very special issue to call to your attention today. It's unfortunate that we're sort of mired in the dog days of summer because people's attention is elsewhere. They want to squeeze the last few moments of enjoyment out of the summer. Maybe they're getting their kids ready to go back to school. Maybe they're getting ready to go back to school or to work. And a very, very important issue is looming because as soon as Congress reconvenes, some pretty bad stuff is going to come down. There is a bill that has been introduced in the Senate. It's called Senate Bill S-959 that is going to regulate compounding pharmacies. The source of the controversy, many of you a couple of weeks ago saw a dramatic edition of 60 Minutes where they told the grim story of individuals, many people, who got sick because of tainted injectable steroids, some cases went directly into their spinal cords, and now they're suffering from serious, life-threatening, sometimes fatal fungal infections. This is a terrible tragedy, and we need to pay some attention to how we formulate drugs in this country. But as Rahm Emanuel once said, never let a good crisis go to waste, and Congress is hot in pursuit of new regulations that would restrict our access to specialized drugs and natural products of our choice via compounding pharmacies. And so I've invited a representative. She's been involved in the public health process. She's Marcy Bliss. She's president of Wedgewood Pharmacy, which is a compounding pharmacy right here in the Northeast. It's in Swedesboro, New Jersey. And she's here to talk to us a little bit about the implications of this new bill, S-959, a new Senate bill that may be voted on as soon as the 9th of September. Welcome, Marcy. It's nice having you here on Intelligent Medicine Podcast.
Thank you very much, Dr. Hoffman, and I really appreciate you giving us the time to discuss this important issue.
Okay, so tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got involved with the compounding issue.
Okay, well, I manage a compounding pharmacy, as you said, that's in the Northeast. We're in New Jersey, and I've worked at this pharmacy for 15 years, the past 15 years. As many compounding pharmacies do, we have certain specialties that we work in. We specialize in certain segments of human health, including urology. We make medications for erectile dysfunction. We compound 17-alpha-hydroxyprogesterone for women at risk. It's commonly prescribed for women that have had previous preterm births. We compound naltrexone injections and pellets, and we also serve the animal health market. So we make many medications for dogs, cats, horses, and exotics and such. That's my professional relationship with compounding, but I also am the mother of a 14-year-old boy that was diagnosed with autism when he was 2 years old, and he was a very sick baby, and I believe that the use of personalized medicine really saved his life. We went to see doctors who looked at him and put us on certain nutritional programs as well as nutritional programs, eating programs, and compounded medication, really, because there was not FDA drugs available to treat what was going on with him, that helped him get healthy, and as a result, he made significant progress developmentally. And it's important to me personally and professionally that these kinds of medications are available.
Well, discuss the whole rationale for compounding pharmacies, because a lot of people think of pharmacies, you know, that old-fashioned pharmacy that's rapidly disappearing because the big chains are eating up the small pharmacies, and so we have the Duane Reeds of the world and the Genovese and you name it. These are pharmacies that are a big chain pharmacies where, you know, you can go and you can get your prescription medication. So what's wrong with that picture? Why do we need unique, personalized compounding pharmacies to make special formulas?
That's a really good question. many people don't know, but even chain drugstores do a little bit of compounding. It's a very small part of their practice, but in the state of New Jersey, every pharmacist is required to be able to compound. So a lot of times at the chains, they make things like steroid creams that are in possibly a different dosage than what is available from an FDA manufacturer. Maybe somebody is sensitive to the steroid and they need a lower dose of the steroid, for example, so they might do something like that at a chain. They also can flavor a medication frequently if it's for a pediatric patient and or if it's a tablet and it needs to be put in some kind of formula that can be taken by an elderly person, say, as a suspension. So that's really where the specialty of compounding began to expand, and it was probably 15 years ago that community pharmacies were starting to see more and more patients whose needs were not being met by the one-size-fits-all FDA-manufactured medication. And so they started to specialize this in this and let doctors know, hey, if you have patients that are difficult to treat or patients that are not compliant with their medication therapy because of the dosage form or the strength, or it's difficult to break down a tablet into six pieces because you need to give it to a child or to a cat, pharmacy started to fill that need in the marketplace. And as they did, I think doctors really saw the advantages of being able to personalize therapies in a way that they couldn't, you know, with FDA-approved drugs.
And I'll tell you how I use compounding pharmacies. I use compounding pharmacies in some cases to make thyroid medications. If, for example, a patient doesn't tolerate a type of thyroid medication, I might ask for a slow release or time release version of a thyroid medication, or I might ask for a dye-free version, or if the patient has celiac disease, I might ask for a version of medication that doesn't have any starch that comes from wheat. I might ask a compounding pharmacy to make me some kind of specialized pain cream that might involve an admixture of several different types of drugs. It's not available on the market, but the formulas work, and they've been lifesavers some of my patients with chronic pain problems. Mm-hmm. I like to use compounding pharmacies to make low-dose naltrexone, which is actually it's a regular medication, but it's a much weaker version of the regular medication. We don't want to give the full strength, so we might give one-tenth the potency of the regular medication. And I use compounding pharmacies to make bioidentical hormones for women in menopause and for men who are suffering from low testosterone. And so I, you know, probably not a day goes by that I don't call my compounding pharmacy to make special medications. We haven't had any problems in the 20, 25 years that I've been using compounding pharmacies. And yet this new bill threatens the autonomy of doctors and threatens access from patients and also puts some real heavy-duty restrictions on some of the compounding pharmacies. But let's go back to the original tragedy, the tragedy that occurred due to compounding, actually, real horrible practices, malpractice by a pharmacy in Massachusetts. Can you review that for our listeners?
I can. It was a pharmacy in Massachusetts. The name of the pharmacy was the New England Compounding Center. And I wasn't personally involved with that pharmacy or in any of the investigations. So most of my report is really what I've heard through the news, just like you've probably heard through the news or through industry communication. So I have no inside track on what happened there. But what seemed to happen is that they had fungal contamination of medication that was intended to be sterile, so it was not sterile. And they sold this medication through purchase orders to hospitals and clinics all around the United States. And when this medication was injected into the spines and in some cases the joints of patients, they had fungal infections. And in the spine, those were particularly difficult to treat. So tragically, there were deaths associated with this operation. And it seems that, again, from the press reports, that they weren't following some of the common standards that most compounding pharmacies follow, and that is the United States Pharmacopeia standards. There are standards for both non-sterile and sterile compounding. And it seems like they were also not following state law. State law requires that compounding is only done on a doctor's order. Either the doctor orders it for office use or the doctor orders it for a specific patient. And in this case, they were selling through purchase orders without the doctor's I think the purchasing department was ordering, and the doctors weren't even aware in some cases they were using compounded medication. So it was a highly unusual situation.
They were using, like, names, fictitious names for patients. They just said, you know, give us a bunch of names. They never checked to see whether they were going to real patients. They would get names like Homer Simpson, Lisa Simpson.
I've read that as well.
You know, and, you know, just made up names.
And so it really was not a typical experience that doctors and patients have with compounding pharmacies. It was something that was out of the ordinary. They were breaking the law. But now they're trying to legislate for everybody, for all the good actors who are out there, you know, serving patients and using these medications. And
so this is actually an interesting point, because we often hear this mantra when it comes to vitamins and supplements. And I've seen it in the newspapers, in, you know, quite respectable newspapers. They say that vitamin supplements are unregulated,
mm-hmm.
which is actually not true. They are subject to very stringent regulations. And so based on the false argument that vitamins and supplements aren't regulated, they want to further empower the government, the Federal Trade Commission, the FDA, to regulate the supplement industry. But actually, regulations are in place. It's just that, you know, they generally, bureaucracies in the federal government are desirous of more purview, more regulatory authority. And it seems to me that this is kind of a, you know, it's like a casus belli. You know, the term is a term which means that using a pretext to start a war. I mean, mm-hmm. the Germans invaded Poland, alleging that the Poles had attacked the Germans, but actually that was trumped up. You know, we've seen that in American history at various times too, that we've claimed that our adversaries have attacked us, but actually we were looking for an opportunity to move in. And similarly, it seems like we've got a situation here where, boy, you know, this is a great congressional initiative. We're going to protect the public. But the laws, from what you described, the laws are in place. And the pharmacies that I use, they don't mass produce injectable drugs for hospitals and for medical specialists. They prescribe unique formulations on an individual basis for doctors who, both conventional doctors and complementary physicians, who want to do it slightly differently.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And as a parallel to what you said about the nutritional market, the practice of pharmacy and compounding as part of that practice is regulated currently by the states, just like the practice of medicine is regulated by the states. So there is regulation in place, and it was there in the state of Massachusetts, but nobody was acting
on
it.
But the system failed.
The legislation was there. There was a breakdown. Right.
Right. So, you know, a terrible tragedy occurred. And therefore, and look, I'm all for limited federal regulation if that's going to help avoid future tragedies like this. There's no question that Massachusetts, they missed the boat in terms of this terrible problem. And it's a tragedy, and we need to avert tragedies. And if federal oversight could make a difference, great. But what else? I mean, this bill, S-959, it's a very voluminous bill, as many bills are these days. You know, it's kind of like Nancy Pelosi says, you know, if you want to know what's in the bill, you'll have to pass it first. S-959 has lots of provisions in it, and they don't seem to pertain just to this tragedy. They actually may ultimately restrict access to some very useful formulations and bioidentical hormone replacement, some of the things that you've talked about in relationship to specialized autism treatments. Talk to us about what might ultimately be restricted.
Well, the types of things that there's different ways that the restrictions are going to apply. One is by the requirements for there to be a USP monograph for the medication that is compounded, or if there's no monograph, that it's part of a substance that's already a component of a drug that's been approved by the FDA.
So that's a little technical. Explain what that means.
It is technical, but what it means is there are, you know, the United States Pharmacopeia develops this thing they call the national formulary. And a lot of times, especially medications that integrative medicine physicians use may not be on the national formulary, and they may not be part of a drug substance that's been approved. We make medications here that doctors request because they were never a component of an approved drug.
Well, wait a minute. So, that sounds bad. That sounds like they're unapproved. Does that mean that they're bad, they're dangerous, they're experimental, or that they're harmful potentially to patients? I mean, that's what some people in the Senate are going to allege. They're going to say, let's cut down on the use of the indiscriminate use of things that are, quote, unapproved.
Yes, it does not mean that they're not safe, the fact that they're unapproved. Everything that you would get compounded from a pharmacy that's personalized for you, is by its nature not an FDA-approved drug. Just because having FDA approval means that you've taken that individual drug in that dosage form
at a specific dose.
Yes, through the approval process. So, for example, if you're ordering a medication that's gluten-free, that gluten-free medication hasn't gone through the drug approval process. It would take, hundreds of millions of dollars in many years.
But,
just to make it gluten-free.
But it contains the active ingredients of a medication that might be formulated with, frankly, wheat flour, because we see this from time to time in standard medications.
Right. And in the case of my son, for example, he was sensitive to dyes and at times was on a completely sugar-free diet. So they also, in sweeteners for pediatric medications, he couldn't have those sweeteners. He wasn't allowed to have artificial sweeteners or sugars for a very long period of time. So we had to have medication made without those ingredients. Those medications were safe, and I felt very comfortable giving him those medications.
Right.
But one of the medications he was on that was really critical to him getting better was a medication called methyl B12 injections. It's a methylated form of B12.
Right.
It's not available as an FDA-approved drug. And that drug
I use it all the time.
That's right. And that drug does not have a United States pharmacopeia monograph. So that drug
We use the term drug loosely. Actually what we're talking about is an activated form of a nutrient, vitamin B12.
Right.
But technically, if it's injected, it would be considered a drug.
That's right. That's what makes it a drug, is the fact that it's injected and done by prescription with a pharmacy.
Right.
So, but that drug in this legislation would not be available to populations of patients that use it today.
Oh, that would really upset quite a few of my patients, because they really rely upon that. I mean, this would have a really disastrous effect on my practice. And I think a lot of people are asleep at the switch on this. This is something that can overtake us stealthily in the night, as it were, because people are busy, it's summertime, and then, the pace picks up in the month of September. And Congress is likely to pull a fast one here unless we're very, very vigilant.
That is true. The other thing that is at risk for people that treat people with menopause is bioidentical hormones. The FDA tried to stop compounding at the request of pharmaceutical manufacturers that made synthetic hormones.
Wait a minute. Let me interrupt you. What you said is very important.
Okay.
Is it at the this is would be considered a violation of the Sherman Antitrust Act if we were in a real world, because we're talking about the big pharma, the pharmaceutical industry, which makes standard synthetic hormones, is trying to put the kibosh on very small independent pharmacies who are manufacturing natural hormones, perhaps, less than, 2% or 1% of the American population, a real minority, are taking these custom bioidentical hormones, and yet they want to shut that down and make people more reliant on their drugs. I mean, we've got an antitrust suit potentially there.
Yes, and that was in the late 2000s that at the request of those pharmaceutical manufacturers, the FDA tried to say that you could not compound with estriol. And they didn't have the authority at that time to stop people from compounding with estriol, but this legislation gives them that authority.
Right, and estriol is a very, very useful type of estrogen. It's one of the safest estrogens around. And by the way, lots of research is underway on estriol as a compound that might help conditions like multiple sclerosis. So I guess if they go through the process, they might get it approved. It might ultimately be available several years hence at a much increased price. to women who now can obtain it via compounding pharmacies.
That's correct.
Wow.
That's correct.
Scary stuff.
Another important role that compounding pharmacies play is during a backorder situation. So especially these days, and you've probably heard about it in the news, there are frequent incidences where FDA manufacturers put something on backorder or discontinue a drug.
We had this with thyroid. We had this a big panic because women weren't able to get their natural thyroid. So we went to the compounding pharmacies, and the compounding pharmacies made it available.
That's right. So I think that people are going to be in a position where if the FDA is given authority to make decisions about what appropriate medical treatments are and which drugs are clinically different than other drugs, and doctors are required to do additional documentation on their prescriptions to justify their prescribing of these kinds of medications, I think it's just going to cause an extraordinarily increased administrative burden on the doctors. It's going to increase costs at the pharmacy, which are going to be passed on to the patients. And I think it's very problematic.
I think what you're saying, translation, and I didn't realize this until I prepared for this interview, is that part of this proposal is that we doctors who prescribe natural therapies or compounded medications, in effect, we'll have to sing for our meal. Right now, if I want a compounding medication, I've made the medical judgment that my patient needs a compounding medication. I hit the speed dial. I call my compounding pharmacy. I call in the prescription. The prescription is then delivered to the patient. End of story. It's very easy.
That's right. What
you're saying is that if I were to do that in a future scenario, if this bill gets passed in its entirety, is I will have to maybe fill out lengthy documentation to tell the FDA why it is that I want to prescribe the natural thing instead of the regular synthetic drug that's on the formulary, and that'll have to be reviewed by some bureaucrat probably who may take several weeks to get back to me. And then I can find out if I am entitled to prescribe something which in my judgment is beneficial for my patient. That's not a very happy state of affairs to envision.
Yes, we're concerned that this legislation gives the FDA authority over the practice of medicine for that reason.
Precisely. I mean, and who better to judge whether something is suitable for a patient than their personal physician? It really hamstrings one's doctor and interferes with the doctor-patient relationship to a very serious degree. We talk about some changes in the practice of medicine, and a lot of doctors getting frustrated and dropping out. I mean, this is something that could have a lot of doctors heading for the exits.
Yeah. And sadly, even though the compounding pharmacy industry agrees wholeheartedly with the concept of protecting patients, this bill doesn't really protect patients for a couple of reasons. It exempts hospital pharmacies from the kinds of regulations that community, family-owned compounding pharmacies would have to adhere to. So it exempts the largest group of patients who actually receive compounded medication in the United States, and that's people who are being treated in hospitals. The second thing is there's no national standard in the legislation. What we had been asking the Senate help staff to include in the legislation is that in every state, pharmacies would have to adhere to a set of USP standards, because that isn't standard across the United States. It varies by state. And so we said make it a national standard that pharmacies have to adhere to USP 795 and 797 standards.
Makes sense.
And neither of those, well, there is an exemption for hospitals, and the USP standards are not in the legislation. So if you're doing business within your state, it doesn't change the standards within that state. It doesn't make them USP 797 required standards. It just you follow the state regulations.
So I currently do business with a compounding pharmacy in New Jersey, and I practice in the state of New York. Would this restrict my patients' access to items from this pharmacy, because it would be considered interstate commerce or interstate shipping of pharmaceuticals?
That's right. It would be. And it would impact them, and it depends on whether the medications that you're prescribing are sterile medications or non-sterile medications. So if they're sterile medications and if the pharmacy is compounding them in anticipation of the prescriptions, which they typically do based on their order history, and if they're shipping across state lines, they would be required to register in a new category called compounding manufacturer.
Mm-hmm.
And that new category actually would not permit them to dispense medication directly to patients. If they do those three practices and they register as a compounding manufacturer, they're then only permitted to sell to hospitals and clinics directly. They're
wow.
no longer to allow
so individual
to
physicians.
Dispense medication
to that patients. That could be a real disaster for physicians like me because we administer sterile, we call them medications, but actually they're sterile vitamins. I can't get the right kind of vitamins from these big pharmaceutical firms. Their selection is very limited. So, for example, if I want methylcobalamin or a certain form of another B vitamin or selenium or zinc in a form that I can administer in an intravenous formula to patients,
mm-hmm.
I will get a compounding pharmacy to custom manufacture sterile products for me. But my compounding pharmacy is another state, and therefore I'll be cut off from access to those. My patients won't be able to get their IVs.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Even if you were using a pharmacy in your own state, there would be limitations on office use. You mentioned that you infuse the medication
right.
occasionally, or
yes.
you might administer medications in the office.
Right.
In this legislation, even if you used a pharmacy that was in state, you would be limited to the amounts of office use that the pharmacy could dispense to you. So it can't be more than 10% of their dispensing for office use. And then within 15 days of dispensing the medication, you would have to report back to the pharmacy
right.
the patient that used the medication, and there's criminal penalties if
okay.
the pharmacy doesn't follow these rules.
Okay.
So it's really a huge administrative burden for the doctor who's
yeah,
trying to administer the medication and for the pharmacy.
And big inventory control issues because you'd have to keep ordering and ordering and ordering. And, you know, patient, doesn't show up 1 week for their IV, you know, they change their mind. And then you have extra medication on hand, and then you have to just throw it out.
Yes, because it has a 15-day beyond use date on it, even if there's scientific data showing that it can last longer than that.
Never, knock wood. I got a piece of wood right here near me. Never had a problem with, any of the sterile compounding items that we've administered to patients over many, many, many years.
Yeah.
So this is terrible. So call to action here. We can continue talking a little bit about this, but we're deep into this podcast, and I want to give our listeners a place that they can go if they want to register their concerns. www.protectmycompounds.com. Tell us about that.
That is a site that was started by an organization called the Professional Compounding Centers of America. This is not my website, but I know
right.
of it. And it's a website where people can go to read about the details of S959 and how it's going to impact their access to medication. And there are also tools on there that they can write to their congressman. So if you click on one of the links on a particular issue that you're interested in, like BHRT or autism spectrum disorders, there's a pre-written memo that you can change and edit and add your personal story to and hit the send button, and already in the database is the email addresses of your representatives from your area. You put in your zip code. So it makes it very easy for you to share with Congress your concern about this legislation and the impact it's going to have on you as a patient or as a practitioner.
You know, there are a lot of things happening in this country, you know, things that are disturbing, the NSA spying on Americans. And, you know, we hear about this in the news. We hear about the IRS being involved in investigating and, in fact, persecuting certain organizations. And, you know, that sort of washes over us because we go, you know, what can we do? You know, it's government. It's a big bureaucracy. But this is an encroachment that is really affecting many of us precisely where we live in terms of our health, in terms of the health of our families, our children, and our pets, because there's a big provision here that's going to give the FDA authority to severely eliminate compounded treatment options for dogs, cats, and horses. And last time I checked, none of the victims of that fungal contamination were animals. It was about people. So in one broad stroke, We're trying to reform the whole compounding industry by restricting their ability to make products for animals. What's up with that, and why should pet owners be concerned?
Well, the current state of the legislation and the draft it's in now has had the animal health provisions removed. So as a pharmacy that serves a lot of animal health patients, we were glad to see that.
Okay, good.
Those provisions were removed after two things happened. Over 30,000 pet owners wrote to Congress and said, this doesn't work for us and our pets.
That's the power of the grassroots. Because we in the natural health movement, the parents of autistic children, women on bioidentical hormone replacement, people who rely on these things, maybe not as organized a constituency or as vocal a constituency as pet owners, but when the pet owners are going to descend on Washington, that's when congressmen, senators, and members of the House of Representatives listen.
Yes. The other thing that happened I thought that was really useful is there was a survey sent to veterinarians about the impact this is going to have on their practice and patients and the particular provisions. And the doctor spoke up, too, and said, look, this will have a severe negative impact on our patients.
Right.
And I think what's happening on the human health side is human health patients don't realize that this is out there. Human health doctors don't realize the impact of it. So there isn't as much engagement with Congress on these issues right now.
Okay. So now, in terms of the timetable for this, Congress will return on September 9th, and supporters of the bill are going to try and bring it up quickly, maybe sneak it through passage as early as the first week that they're back. And there's bipartisan support for this bill, by the way. You know, if you think this is a Democrat or Republican issue, it's not, because, I think a lot of these congressmen and women, they are do-gooders. They want to reform. They want to protect their constituents, and they just don't get it. I think an example of which was the education that Senator McCain received when, you know, he was all for, you know, more strict enforcement of regulations over supplements, but he was misinformed because he didn't realize that what it was, you know, he thought it was about, you know, people getting tainted athletic supplements and ending up like A-Rod. But what the ultimate consequence of that legislation a few months back was that there was going to be major restrictions on supplements of our choice. And then he was bombarded by his constituents, and he did an about face. He said, gee, I'm sorry, you know, well, I'm going to back off on this. These congresspeople really need to be made aware of the implications of this legislation. It sounds great on the face of it. We're going to protect patients, no more tragedies, you know, horrible players. We'll get government inspections, and they'll be taken offline if they're not doing things in a sterile and medically correct way. I'm all for that. But the restrictions that are going to ensue are just going to be terrible. The House is also working on a version of this compounding legislation, but it seems they're a little more reasonable than the Senate.
Yes, we think the House bill does a much better job, first of all, protecting patients. It sets national standards without exemptions. It retains state board of pharmacy accountability without limiting the FDA, who already has authority, and it improves communication between the states and the FDA. So if you're looking for a bill that actually protects patients, we think the House side is doing a good job. Their bill is not out of committee yet, but the drafts we've seen look much better than what we see on the Senate side.
Do you mind sharing with us a little bit about your experience with your autistic child? And because you tantalized us with describing some of the unique formulations that have been created for the autistic spectrum disorder. Can you share with us your experience as a parent? What some of these innovative therapies are and what they've done for your son?
Sure. My son, as I said, was diagnosed with autism 12 years ago. He was 2 years old, and he was a very sick baby. He had horrible gastrointestinal issues, chronic diarrhea, vomiting. He had atopic disorders. He was covered with eczema from head to toe and would scratch himself until he bled. He had airway reactive disorder, so he had issues breathing. A lot of immune system things going on with him and digestive system things going on with him. And all the conventional medication treatments we tried just made him sicker and sicker and sicker. He was on so much Tylenol for ear infections and, you know, gastric motility drugs and, you know, conventional medicine initially. And he just never, he regressed. He was developing up until about the age of 2, and then he lost his language. And after he lost his language, we started to pursue, you know, what was wrong. So we had early intervention come in, and they suggested a neurologist who diagnosed him with autism. After taking him to a couple of more doctors, I started doing research on the internet because it was available and there wasn't a whole lot of information out there about autism or how to treat it. And thank God I came across a group of doctors. At the time it was an organization called Defeat Autism Now.
Yes, Dan.
Yes, the Dan organization. And I signed up for a conference, and within a month of my son being diagnosed, I was at the Dan conference, and I thank God for
right.
that.
That's, I mean, God bless you know, you parents of autism spectrum disorder kids, because your advocacy has made such a difference in the outcomes for your children.
Absolutely. And so I learned there of doctors who hadn't given up on my kids like the neurologist had and said, you know, just go home and try to accept the fact that your son has autism. These doctors said there's hope, there's possibility. You could treat the medical things that are wrong with your son and he could develop and learn and grow. And so I hung my hat on that hope, and we never looked back. So we put him on a gluten-free, casein-free diet. We started, you know, deep doctors that were in this kind of biomedical treatment of autism practice, which we paid cash for because insurance, of course,
right,
didn't cover any of these treatments.
That's off the grid, yeah.
Off the grid. And then we also used a fair amount of compounded medication. We used antifungal therapies because he had an overgrowth of yeast in his body.
Mm-hmm.
We used detoxifying therapies because he had heavy metal poisoning and high levels of pesticides in his body.
You used a DMSA, possibly?
We used DMSA.
Yep.
We used allergy treatments because he was very allergic.
Mm-hmm.
And we did put him on methyl B12 injections
right.
when he was 3. And I'll tell you, in the first 6 months after putting him on those B12 injections, he gained 18 months of language.
Wow.
And so we continued with these biomedical treatments for 4 or 5 years until he entered school. And really by then, he had become so much healthier. You know, his diarrhea had resolved, his eczema had resolved, his reactive airway disorder had resolved, except when he had, you know, a chest cold. And he ended up now, I mean, he's going into high school this year, he's mainstreamed.
Wow.
And he's been going through school mainstreamed. And this
wow.
was a child that doctors said had a 50-50 chance of never speaking.
That is so inspiring and so exciting.
And so I can't imagine that another child that's diagnosed today with autism is going to go to a doctor in 6 months from now and be told, well, we used to have these drugs
yep.
available to us,
yep.
but they're not available anymore.
Yeah. Well, that's the crux of it, and that's a very, very personal message. But the message equally applies for women who've achieved outstanding benefits from natural bioidentical hormones. Some of them had been on conventional, readily available pharmaceutical drugs from conventional doctors, did not achieve control of their menopausal symptoms, had to resort to bioidentical hormones, and did much better. I saw today a patient who had been on standard thyroid therapy. She came to me and said, when she first came in, she said, I'm suffering from major depression. And I said, what's major depression? She said, well, it goes way beyond depression. I can't even tell you how inert and bad I feel. And I saw her today. We had switched her to naturally compounded, natural desiccated thyroid. And I said, how are you doing? You know, let's pretend this is your first visit. The complaint window is open. Tell us what's going on. And to my surprise, she said, well, I don't have really a lot to complain about. I'm, you know, a little tired, but I feel so much better on that natural thyroid that you prescribed. And I wasn't even sure if we had nailed the proper dose, so I retested her, and, you know, we'll find out if she might even feel better if we properly adjust the dose according to her blood tests. But this is, I mean, the examples abound. I see this on a daily basis in my practice, and I really hate to see this go away because of a misguided attempt to regulate the compounding pharmacy industry. I partner with compounding pharmacies. They're an essential resource for me to get my work done to help patients achieve their goals.
Yes, and not FDA drugs do not meet the needs of all patients. So we need to have these medications available for those whose needs aren't met.
Absolutely. So once again, the pitch is please get involved. The website is, let's see, it's protectmycompounds.com. And I'll put that up on my Facebook page, and we'll talk about it in our newsletter, and I'll mention it on our Health Talk broadcast as well. And we need to get the word out. So where do you think this is going?
Well, I do think that the Senate is going to look at this quite aggressively when they come back in September. I hope the House is inserting their ideas into the conversation because they seem like, you know, ideas that better protect patients as well as prevent any kind of access issues for patients. So, I mean, I don't know. We're going to stay involved in the conversation. It's very important to me, again, personally, as the mother of a child with autism, as well as professionally, that this legislation...
And you've been to Washington, and you've actually sat in legislators' offices, and you've told the moving story of that you just recounted to our audience about your child's progress. And do we have we enlisted any support? Is anybody listening? Do we have allies in Congress?
Well, you know, as you said earlier, there's a lot of members of Congress and their staffers who are trying to do the right thing. And I think those people are willing to listen to people's stories and the individual cases of why this is important. I think there are also powerful groups that have the intent of reducing access to compounded medication. Mm-hmm. And we mentioned them earlier, people who lose sales when people turn to bioidentical hormones. They're not making money off of the hormones that are synthetic, or the same case in animal health. People that are flavoring medication, liver flavored for a cat, aren't using a tablet that might be available from an FDA manufacturer. And I think those forces are very powerful. They have a lot of money, and they're on the Hill every day educating Congress.
They've got professional lobbyists. They spend big bucks. Mm-hmm. They contribute to the campaigns. They've got very, very extensive resources, and that's what worries me about our government, is that a form of crony capitalism is really taking over in Washington, and powerful forces are shaping our destinies. And I think we as citizens have to appeal to our legislators to listen, and if they don't listen, elect legislators who are responsible.
But what we have on our side really are patients who are impacted, and pet owners who are impacted, and parents who are impacted. And those numbers outnumber any number of pharmaceutical lobbyists that can be on Capitol Hill on the other side of the issue. But we need to have those people engaged and telling their stories.
Well, I'll tell you, if in terms of telling the story, I would take you over 20 pinstriped pharmaceutical lobbyists if I wanted to go down to Washington and impress a legislator, because you really have beautifully articulated the situation. We're talking to president of Wedgewood Pharmacy. She's Marcy Bliss, and Marcy hasn't started, but she's supportive of the call to action. www.protectmycompounds.com, and that's a place where you need to go to find out how you can get involved and call your legislator. Let them know that this is not something that we want. Thank you very much, Marcy, for joining us. Any final words?
No, I just really appreciate Dr. Hoffman, the time today, and you're very knowledgeable on compounding and its uses and benefits, and so I really appreciate the interview and the time to talk about this important issue.
My pleasure, and you know, we may call upon you for progress reports as this issue works its way through the legislative process. Thank you for joining us. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.